God's name, do you need a solvent for except to kill someone?
That's an outrageous slur.
Google it, mate.
The only way that you can preserve peace is to prepare for war.
Views on News with Mark Latham. Mark
Latham. It's Sunday morning, bit after 10 o'clock, and as always, we have a chat with Mark Latham. G'day, Mark.
G'day, Brent. Good to be with you.
Likewise.
Bit of Christmas in the air. You can feel it coming, can't you?
You can, yeah. I tell you what, though, what you can feel coming over the next couple of days, Mark, is hot, 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 hot weather.
Yeah, yeah, until Wednesday. The old-fashioned heat wave. Oh, well, it's summer.
It is.
We're in Australia. That's
what
we
expect.
Yep.
This week, the long-awaited costings of the Federal Opposition's nuclear energy plan finally landed. Mr. Dutton unveiled them. He placed the price tag for building 7 nuclear reactors at $331 billion. The announcement marks a crucial moment in the energy debate, especially as experts continue to argue over whether nuclear power can truly compete with renewables on cost. It is good to see that finally, Mark, Mr. Dutton has tabled exactly the sort of dollars we're looking at to put these 7 nuclear reactors together.
Yeah, they're big numbers, though, aren't they? It's a reminder of how expensive net zero will be nationwide. Dutton's saying that with the construction of the 7 nuclear power plants, $331 billion it'll cost over the next 26 years through to 2050, and that's cheaper than the Labor plan of $594 billion. But, you know, they're mind-boggling numbers, really, and when you consider Australia can't do a lot to change the global climate, you'd have to ask why. We have had a reliable, affordable power system for many decades now, but this is the cost of net zero. And Dutton, I suppose, has the advantage of, while these nuclear power plants are very expensive, he can claim 2 offsetting cost savings. One is in the construction of new transmission wires, because he's doing the nuclear power plants as part of the existing grid of transmission, so he doesn't have to build or spend as much money on wiring up western parts of New South Wales and the like for wind and solar. And the second saving is in not having to have as much backup power. Nuclear really is his backup power. I think that's the way it's used in other countries around the world that have got renewables. They use the nuclear for when the sun's not shining, the wind's not blowing. So you need to take that into account. Albanese and Chris Bowen will obviously run a scare campaign. It's very expensive. They'll say there's the danger of nuclear meltdown and the like. But they're fake scare campaigns. I think the Dutton plan for the long-term future of Australia, if you want to go net zero, if that's your preference, and it seems to be a bipartisan position in Canberra, then the Dutton plan makes a fair bit of sense.
It has been, for me anyway, sitting back looking, it's been funny for me to watch the Chris Bowens of the world come out over the last couple of days and try to, in many ways, make fun of what has been announced on Friday by Peter Dutton. And they aren't able to, with any credibility at all, put forward arguments against Peter Dutton's plan.
Well, the main weakness that Bowen and others have on the renewables front is where's the backup power? Batteries won't do the job. Schemes like Snowy 2.0 pumped hydro are massively expensive, mightn't even come online. And they're also against the gas peaking plants because they contain carbon. So this is the great weakness in the Labor Party, the Greens, and big parts of the Liberal Party in New South Wales. Where's the backup power that keeps the lights on? And to some extent, Brent, you know, I've always said in Australia we've been spoiled by that reliable, affordable power system, coal-based, we've had in the past. But the day the lights go out on a mass scale, and it's not just sort of a storm that knocked over some wires, it's not a temporary blip in the system, it's a long-term blackout that runs for days and days because we haven't got the backup power. Say, in the middle of winter when you have a wind drought and you obviously haven't got as much solar, say, on the days we're talking about in the next couple of days in the heat wave in the future, when we just haven't got the backup power in place. Well, that's when people are going to realise the folly of the renewable fetish, and we should have had a more balanced electricity grid. Sure, with renewables, maybe 20, 30, 35% of the system, some gas peaking plants to provide backup support, and nuclear to be the backbone of the system because it's reliable, affordable, base load power.
I don't know, Mark. You can't, you know, saw sawdust, as I often say, but you look in the mirror and you think there are still so many countries that are using, you know, coal to generate power. If only we had continued down that road, our power prices would not be, I would assume, would not be anywhere near as expensive as they are in
today. They're the two mistakes in Australia. One, the delusion that we can change the world's climate with 1.3% of carbon emissions, which is a very low amount, especially compared to the big emitters like Europe, North America, China, India, and so forth. So that's the first delusion. And the second one is that why did this transition have to be so rapid? Like, if you believe in it, why are we closing down coal-fired power stations now, and also at New South Wales level, massive subsidies to keep Eraring going? Why did we rush into this transition over 10 years? This is the plan that Matt Keane had in New South Wales. It all had to be done in a decade, basically to suit the renewable energy lobby and rent seekers. It could have been done over three decades, a steady, phased transition that gave you the chance of getting it right. And not many people would think there's a lot of common sense in closing down the old transmission system for electricity before you've got the new one up and running and proven to work. And there's been a leap of faith with systems like Snowy 2.0 costing $20 billion, and that Chris Marr wants to joke about something. He should joke about Snowy 2.0 under his own nose. So the transition has been massively rushed. It didn't have to be one decade. It could have been over three or four, and we'd be in much better shape.
Anti-Semitism. It's becoming a troubling issue in Australia, with incidents ranging from hateful graffiti to targeted harassment making headlines. Some argue it's fuelled by global tensions. Others point to online radicalisation and societal divisions. Mark, what do you think of the root causes? It seems to be getting worse each and every week, doesn't it, of late?
Well, I think there's only one cause, and that is bringing the troubles of the Middle East to Australian streets. And after the Hamas terrorist attack on Israel on the 7th of October last year, we've seen the anti-Semitism grow and grow to the point where it's kind of institutionalised. Every Palestinian radical knows they can get on the TV news if they put up some anti-Israel graffiti and a few swear words on a wall in the eastern suburbs of Sydney, or do something worse, like burning a car, or what the terrible attack that we had at that synagogue in Melbourne. So people know that their cause in the media gets a higher profile if they do these things, and it's the curse of allowing, over the last 14 months, the troubles of the Middle East, the entrenched violence and burning hatreds between the Arab states and Israel, Muslim versus Jew, unfortunately has been allowed to come to Australia. And a lot of the politicians now tutting about it and saying they're going to bring in new hate laws and new restrictions. I'm talking here about Chris Minns. They're the ones who allowed this to fester in the first place. Remember that big march on the Opera House by the Hamas and Palestinian protesters straight after October 7, thousands of them, swarming the Opera House because the government had a plan to put the Jewish or the Israeli flag on the sails of the Opera House. Well, that was an illegal march that wasn't policed, that wasn't stopped. And we've had illegal marches ever since. The Minns government hasn't stopped a single illegal Palestinian pro-Gaza, pro-Hamas march in Sydney. They're all illegal. If you block the traffic, you go down the street and people can't drive in their normal daily business, it's an illegal march, and they haven't stopped any of them. So I think they allowed this to fester early on, and it's got worse, and the people now tutting about it, like Chris Minns, are the ones who are actually to blame.
Well, you talk about Chris Minns. He, last week, is pushing for tougher hate speech laws and tighter restrictions on protests to combat the problems that they now have with this rising extremist activity in New South Wales.
Well, too late. Too late. He's allowed these things and enabled these protesters to think we've got control of the streets. They did. They did. You only had to look at them swarming over the Opera House the night after October 7, the terrible attacks in the Middle East, and the protests ever since. Every Sunday, really, they've had control of the streets. So if you say to a bunch of people, look, there's a law in New South Wales, you can't have these protests blocking streets, but they take control of the streets, well, it enables them and they start to think, oh, well, we're in charge, not the police, not the courts, not the Minns government, we're in charge of these streets so we can do what we like. And that's basically what's been happening. So if you allow lawlessness to fester in the first place, don't be too surprised that it gets out of control.
Well, it goes further than that, though, because when it gets to, you know, we use as an example, being in Newcastle, we used that demonstration a couple of weeks ago. There were more than 100 people arrested. We haven't heard what's gone on. I mean, have they faced magistrates? I'm sure when they do, they'll just get a slap on the wrist. And this is part of the problem.
Yeah, they got bailed out, but the Lord Mayor of Newcastle, newly elected, said, oh, no problem here giving them a permit for a protest because they'll just have a barbecue on the shores. Everyone knew they were going out there to block the big vessels, and 170 of them on the water were arrested. So there's an element of naivety here where politicians think these protests are harmless. In fact, if you allow people to ignore the law and think they are the law, well, obviously they get way out of control. And that's what's happened with the campaign against Jewish people in the eastern part of Sydney. It is localised. Let's not get, you know, too far out of our ground. It is localised in the eastern part of Sydney, as it is in the eastern part of Melbourne, suburbs like Caulfield that have a high concentration of the Jewish population. Where I live in southwest Sydney, out near Camden, there's none of this, Brent, because nobody here has brought the troubles of the Middle East. We haven't got a big number of Muslim people marching on the streets. We haven't got a big number of Jewish people sticking up for Israel and being attacked. So you don't find these debates in suburban parts of Australia. It is a concentrated geographic issue, but a big issue as well, and a lesson for government. Don't let people break the law and willfully allow them to do that, because then they just do it as a way of life, and that's what we're now seeing.
It is. The NRL is set to expand its horizons, of course. The big announcement this week confirmed that Papua New Guinea, PNG, is the newest team. It's a bold move to grow the game internationally with political backing and immense local enthusiasm, political backing, taxpayer backing to the tune of $600 million. The decision marks a historic first for the league. How do you think it's going to impact the NRL's future and its connection to Pacific nations, Mark? Because what do you think the goal is of the Prime Minister in putting this money forward?
Well, in the middle of a cost-of-living crisis, when $600 million could have been better utilised, he's paying it for a football team in Port Moresby to try and combat Chinese influence in New Guinea. And, you know, it's a risky, risky strategy. You could waste all the money, effectively, because can the Chinese outbid us? I mean, can the Chinese promise not $600 million, but $6 billion to the New Guinean government for construction of a port, or infrastructure, or some other sporting endeavour, some other cultural thing up there? The Chinese have got unlimited resources. We haven't. And this is the problem with growing Chinese influence. They buy off, you know, semi-corrupted island states, and let's face it, there's a hell of a lot of corruption in New Guinea. And will they buy off the New Guinean government now in response to this? It's a possibility. We've got a clause, an incredible clause, in the $600 million contract with Papua New Guinea to say that if you signed a security agreement with China, we kick your NRL team out of the comp. So you could just see all the money washed down the drain if that happens. As for the football code itself, I think a lot of fans resent the fact that the rugby league is being used as a political pawn against China, and $600 million is going for a team that apparently is going to be housed and play in a compound. I've been to Port Moresby, Brent. It's not a pretty place. A lot of crime, a lot of safety concerns. I don't think you're going to find many young up-and-coming rugby league players signing a contract, even tax-free, to go live in a compound in Port Moresby when they could be hanging around the beaches and night spots of Bondi and Merriweather and so forth with other footy teams up in Brisbane. So what sort of team they'll have, I think it'll be probably the perpetual wooden spooners because they can't attract the top players. And to live in a security compound in Port Moresby and play there, it's sort of an insult to the game that this is what it's come to.
Well, the Prime Minister on Friday, and this is the Prime Minister from PNG, was one of the big topics, talked about safety and security. And I think he's gone as far as saying that, you know, he will make sure that these players are safe or he will resign his post.
Well, he won't be the first New Guinean Prime Minister to leave office. It's like a revolving door up there. There's a lot of corruption. Crime gangs pay off politicians. That's just a statement of fact. And I would have thought if a rugby league team in the host city can't provide a safe, normal, healthy environment in which to play, how can they get into the comp? And that's my biggest worry. The original suggestion was Port Moresby was so unsafe, this new team would have to play in Cairns in northern Queensland and build a stadium there. But that was kind of ridiculous. How can they be a PNG team if they play in Cairns? So they've gone for this security compound idea, and we'll just have to see how it plays out. When do they come into the comp? 2028? So they've got years to get it right, but it just sounds dodgy from first principles.
New South Wales schools are moving away from teaching classics like Dickens and Orwell in the English curriculum, and this has sparked a debate about the value of traditional literature. Critics argue it risks losing timeless lessons, while supporters say it's a chance to modernise the syllabus. Why do you think these iconic authors are being sidelined, Mark?
Well, unbelievably, the teaching of classical literature, so valuable to young people, is now being polluted by the ideas of gender equality. What's happened here, Brent, is that they're insisting on 50% of the authors in the curriculum being female. Now, it's just a statement of history. It's not anyone's fault in particular, anyone who's alive today. But 100, 200 years ago, when some of these classics were being written, it was a male-dominated society. So Dickens and Orwell are a big part of our classics in literature. Dickens' Great Expectations has been dropped from the curriculum. Orwell's 1984. I mean, people bang on about misinformation and propaganda. Why would you be dropping Orwell's 1984, one of the greatest books ever written, with that important political ramification, drop that from the curriculum? So males are out, female authors are in, and you'd have to say obviously lesser quality than the greats like Dickens and Orwell, and the losers are the students. I remember being in year 11 at high school, and the teacher said, quite rightly, you want to learn how to write fluently and correctly with grammar and readability, read Dickens. Read Dickens and understand how he did it, and as much as you can sort of imitate that structure of writing, which is purely beautiful. So, you know, great advice, and this is why we have the classics. Their lessons are timeless, and students will lose out if they're not reading Dickens, if they're not understanding Orwell, or for what? For female authors who, sure, will come through in the modern era, and I'm sure this will change over time, but for the current cohort of students, you've got to learn the classics, but they've been dumped for political correctness.
That's it. Woke society. Woke wins again.
Woke wins again. The Education Minister Prue Carr ought to pull her head in and realise this is an absurdity. How can you have literature without the classics like Orwell and Dickens, and all for the sake of 50% of authors have got to be female? Probably 100 years from now, all the great authors, there will be a gender balance. But right now, as a product of history, which we can't change, you know, if you're fighting history, you'll always lose. We can't change history, so at least maintain the classics for the benefit of these students.
Today marks the 10th anniversary of the Lindt Cafe siege, a tragedy that shook Australia and led to significant changes in counter-terrorism measures as we remember the victims. Questions remain about how far we've come in ensuring public safety and what lessons we've actually learned. And are we better prepared to prevent such events some 10 years later, Mark?
Well, I suppose the good news out of that tragedy, absolute tragedy, is that 10 years later we haven't had a similar event. There was speculation in 2014 this would be start of a trend, but Man Monis, the terrorist, the murderer at the Lindt Cafe, was a one-off radical, mentally ill person. Lessons there for the legal system, because three times he was bailed. He should never have been on the streets. He should never have been holding people in the Lindt Cafe hostage. So there was a big lesson there, but unfortunately that hasn't been learned in terms of the softness of the judiciary. Counter-terrorism, I'm sure they learned something from it. There was heavy criticism that they didn't act soon enough. Today, snipers who are on the job say they had a clear shot at Monis and were told not to take it. The siege went for nearly a full day. And, you know, on this sad anniversary, we should pay tribute to the lives of Tory Johnson and Katrina Dawson, who were killed in the Lindt Cafe siege. And the lessons really are to, if a sniper's got a shot, take it. I suppose that's one lesson for the legal system. If there's a madman hanging around and got multiple charges against him, don't bail him out. You can't cause harm to people if you're inside jail.
Well, it beggars belief what you just said. I mean, it doesn't it? I mean, that you know, someone with a track record like this was actually allowed out on bail and to go out and do what they did.
Well, one of the charges was conspiring to kill his wife, who was killed in the western suburbs of Sydney, and there were other serious charges against him. So three times he was bailed out. He should never have been on the streets. I'm sure the counter-terrorism forces have learned some lessons from the conduct of that siege, but also in tribute to them, what a difficult situation to be in. It's all right to say, I suppose, take the shot, but if the shot goes astray and kills one of the hostage people, well, you know, it's worse than ever. So not an easy situation, a terrible tragedy that shook Sydney, hasn't happened again, and it did have some political ramifications, because John Robertson, you might recall, was the leader of the New South Wales opposition at the time. He was the member for Blacktown, and he wrote a reference for Mann Monis.
That's right.
Didn't know enough about him, but his office wrote a reference for Mann Monis, saying effectively, you know, this is someone that we're endorsing. And he lost the Labor leadership over that. And ironically, Robertson had been a very strong advocate of an open-door refugee policy into Australia. Minus was a fake refugee who got here as well. So a lot of lessons in counter-terrorism, the legal system, the political system, and also don't allow fake refugees, have stronger vetting of them. And if the foreign affairs system, the immigration system had been stronger, Minus wouldn't have got into the country in the first place because his refugee credentials were completely bogus.
Just before I let you go, voters have slashed Labor's core support. This week it was 27%. This is amid concerns over the cost of living, with many feeling worse off since Labor took power. Now, Peter Dutton has gained traction with voters, backing the coalition to better address their needs over the next 3 years. That's what the surveys say. Despite the PM's reassurances, his message of support has failed to resonate with most voters. Mark, given the shifting political landscape, do you think Labor can regain trust before the next election, whenever it is in 2025, or do you think their goose is cooked, as my dad used to say?
Well, I think they'll be hoping that, you know, when they cook their turkey for Christmas, they won't be the next one in the oven when the people go to the polls. I think what's happening basically is that Dutton is not a big lovable personality, he's not charismatic, but he's seen as a safe bet. And that's a pretty important criteria for the Liberal Party in terms of will the people vote to change government after one term? You wouldn't go to a risky bet. And Dutton, because of his experience, the nature of his character and background in portfolios as a former police officer, he's seen as a steady bet. You know, you wouldn't be taking much of a risk to make him Prime Minister. So that's the thing in favour of the Liberal Party. For Labor, well, Brent, I've been saying to people, I've never seen a political leader like Albanese with such a long run of bad news against him. You know, ever since The Voice, so we're talking well over a year now, the run of the news cycle has been against this guy. A lot of it self-inflicted. He promised big things to make people better off financially. The cost of living crisis has got worse. You've got a big majority of Australians saying they're worse off than they were 3 years ago. So I don't know what Labor can do. Albanese needs a break in the weather, a Tampa-type controversy, maybe the Christmas break or change the mood or bring up some new events. He needs some events. I think it was the British Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan, was asked, what's the most difficult thing in politics? And he said, events, dear chap. Well, events do arise, but Albanese needs those events in the new year to break his way politically. Otherwise, yeah, your dad might be right. His goose will be cooked.
Okay. All right, always good to talk to you. Thank you for your time. We enjoy our chats each and every Sunday. You're on deck next Sunday. Me too.
Yeah, sure. Getting very close to Christmas, and I'm around. Are you on between Christmas and New Year?
I am.
You are? Okay, well, we'll have a talk then. I think the only time is around the 10th of January. I won't be available. I'm taking just a week's break, but only a week. So always happy to talk, Brent. Always a pleasure.
Look forward to it. We'll catch up next Sunday.
Cheers.
Thanks, mate. Bye-bye. That is Mark Latham.